This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode with Rob Guillory. Hey, this is Josh Flanagan with iFanboys Talksplode. Today we are talking to Rob Guillory, known to most of you as the artist on Chew, and now he's got a new book coming out in the near future called Farmhand, and I was really glad to catch up with Rob and chat about his career and his work, his old work, his new work, and all that stuff. I am here on our Talksplode episode today with Mr. Rob Guillory.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Who we've pulled in from the wilderness, as far as I know.
Oh, yes. I have actually literally been in the wilderness for like a year and a half since we finished Chew. I've been wearing a robe, walking around my house for like a year.
How magnificent is your beard?
It's pretty great. It's mostly great at this point, actually.
Yeah.
Which I don't know how that happened.
Three kids. I know exactly how that happened.
I was about to say the same thing.
I bit that joke. I'm sorry. So let's get the big thing out of the way.
Yeah.
At the moment, let's talk about that new series, and then we'll go backwards from there. Chew, you know, is the thing that most people know you from. I don't think that's a surprise to you. And it is a very unique thing. I can't. Chew is one of those things where you can't say it's like this book, or it's like it doesn't look like any book, it doesn't feel like any book. And it was a really big hit. So I'm guessing that coming off of something like that, it left you in sort of a good position, but a strange position. Like, how did you decide where to go from there?
Man, I actually, we wrapped Chew in 2016, and we had always mapped out that it would be 60 issues. But at some point in January of 2016, I knew we were going to wrap in around November of that year. But in January, it occurred to me that, holy crap, this is ending this year. And I literally had a freak out moment where I realized, oh, man, this 8-year gig, which 8-year gigs in comics don't happen. And this was actually, Chew was my first major gig in comics. Like, everything before was just like an anthology here, a short story here. But Chew, I literally jumped in. Chew number one was my first like full comic where I carried the entire art duties for the thing. Mm-hmm. So I literally went from 0 to 100 overnight. As I was winding down January 2016, it occurred to me, holy crap, the gravy train ends this year. So, like, I need to come up with something immediately because, we had, like you mentioned, we had three kids over the course of this 8-year gig. So, like, my life had completely shifted over the course of 8 years of work on this book. So I really started freaking out and started bringing out all of these idea lists I had made over the years. And what a lot of people don't know is that before Chew, everything I had done before Chew was pretty much I was writing it myself, doing writing and drawing on the thing, just because I had no collaborators really to work with. So, while Chew was such an intense gig, I had pretty much shelved the writing. But I had tons of ideas kind of laying around. So I took them all out, started thinking, okay, what's next? I know I want to write my next thing. But I started looking through these idea lists and realizing I hated everything I had written. So immediately I just kind of put it away, and this new thing just kind of emerged. And that's kind of what I've been working on for the last, well, oddly enough, 2 years now. I started working on it that January before Chew ever ended. I started kind of sculpting and gestating on the idea. But by this point, I mean, I've written the first 6 issues. The first three issues are completely done, and I'm finishing pencils on issue 4 next week. So yeah, we're moving along pretty good.
Now we haven't talked about what it is or what it's called yet. So
yeah, I'm waiting.
It's the Farmhand.
I want you
to introduce it and tell me about it, and then I have lots of questions about the process, I suppose. So how would you describe it?
Okay. Well, Farmhand is, in terms of just kind of describing the tone of it, it's kind of hard to put into words because much like Chew, it is a mesh of different genres. Like I love humor, obviously, and art wise, I just kind of go that way. But the thing about it's still suspenseful, as Chew was kind of suspenseful from time to time. But the thing about Chew was, we never really got as into horror as I wanted to go. So the Farmhand is very horror centric, while still maintaining these kind of like humorous overtones. But the general pitch for Farmhand centers around this simple black farmer in South Louisiana named Jedediah Jenkins. And Jedediah Jenkins is a shitty farmer. He's not good at it. He's basically from a line of farmers. And his entire world is turned upside down when he's out plowing his fields, and he suddenly has this crazy supernatural vision. And in that supernatural vision, all this incredibly advanced scientific knowledge is downloaded into his brain, and that it is basically a blueprint for what is eventually becomes the Jedediah seed. And what that seed is, when planted and watered, it grows into human body parts. So overnight, his crappy family farm, becomes this huge scientific trailblazer in South Louisiana, of all places. And he basically becomes a one-stop shop for human body parts, for organ transplants, that kind of thing. And it's the kind of thing where it's not only fast growing, but it's fast healing, where you don't have rejection issues. If you lose a finger, you just pop on a new one, and it immediately becomes your finger, takes on even the scars and tattoos that you had on the old limb. So it's actually like it actually knows what to become. Mm-hmm. But of course, things go south, which is kind of where our story begins.
All right. And it's you have a finite ending for it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have enough story for about 24 to 30 issues if sales are there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we'll see.
Okay, so it's a good long seat in the chair, you know. If you can get that going. It's interesting because, like you said, Chew is really the first book that you were on, and so the look of it to me looks like Chew because that's exactly what Chew is. How are you when you're working on it? Were you trying to get away from sort of the tone? Because you know, Layman wrote Chew, you didn't write that, and you're doing this. Mm-hmm. Are you conscious of the fact that you want to make it different than what you're known for, or is it just sort of how you write and that'll be what it is?
Yeah, I mean, that was something I struggled with at the very beginning because, like you said, like, you know, my art became so synonymous with this, with Chew. The thing is, I never switched up my art to draw Chew. It was just me. So, like, you know, this is like my handwriting. It is what it is. That said, I do think my approach, as I've gotten into drawing the thing, it's taken on its own character. And I think it's a lot more... I'm not doing the coloring on this thing. I'm actually Taylor Wells, who was my color assistant on Chew, is actually handling complete colors on this. So that actually allows me to have time to focus on the writing and the drawing. So I'm actually spending a bit more time in the pencils and inks than I ever spent on Chew. So I think it's a bit richer in terms of detail and everything.
Yeah.
Story wise, I think that I definitely learned a lot from Lehman. I mean, just sitting under him for 8 years, and, you know, before he became a full-time writer, he was an editor at Wildstorm, and he sat under guys. I mean, he edited guys like Grant Morrison, like Warren Ellis, Mark Miller. I mean, he sat under some incredibly talented guys and learned and developed into a hell of a writer himself. I mean, I'm a huge fan. I was a huge fan of John before we ever started working together. So I've kind of absorbed a lot of stuff from him by sitting under him for over the years. But at the same time, there's something about this that is so deeply personal that I think it separates it from Chu just because of how personal it is. It's hard to describe without like spilling it, but it's very different from Chu, while at the same time being silly and kind of goofy from time to time.
Well, yeah, I was curious as I was reading through it, because I know you'd mentioned that it was personal. You don't entirely not look like the main character. It's in South Louisiana. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that a thing that you want to talk about or detail, or is that more, is that going to give something away? Like in what way is this framed in something that makes it personal to you?
Well, it's not, I will say that it's not biographical.
I understand that you do not have a human part farm.
that you know of. No, it's not biographical. I mean, I think, you know, going in, I just kind of gravitated toward making the main character look this way. Mm-hmm. And like you said, like we've discussed before, I'm a family guy right now. Mm-hmm. And Farmhand is usually a family book. It is about, you know, the main character is Ezekiel Jenkins, who is the farmer Jedediah's son. And he's basically he's also a comic creator, coincidentally, but he is a ruined comic creator because he, you know, something happened that we'll discuss later that basically ruined his career, and he's coming off a major bender that basically almost destroyed his marriage and destroyed his family. So there's aspects of him that are very much me, but what's been odd is the more I've gotten into it, the more I'm finding pieces of myself in other characters that I didn't expect. Even characters I don't even like. I'm seeing like, holy crap, I think I'm this guy. Like, how did that happen? But yeah, go ahead.
They're all you, Rob.
I mean, yeah, no, they're definitely all me. They're clearly all me, but there's one character in particular that I did not expect mm-hmm. to be all me, but he is absolutely me.
So was the plan always that you were going to do basically a complete creator owned series that you wrote and drew, or was there a thought that maybe you would go do something else, creator owned work or work for hire or something like that?
I mean, John and I kind of played around with doing some Marvel and DC stuff mm-hmm. and just nothing ever materialized that was anything we cared about. I mean, I think with Marvel and DC, you know, we have such a specific style. Like we were kind of specialized in what we do. I mean, like you said, Chu is very different than most comics. And I think, you know, much like Chu, very few editors, you know, when John was pitching Chu around, very few editors had a vision for it. And the only guy who had a vision for it was Eric Stevenson. Everyone else thought it was a horrible idea that would never make it. So I think when pitching Marvel and DC, I think we're seeing a lot of the same problem, where I don't think they have the vision or the imagination to see what we could do. But we also didn't pursue it very much right. because we're both spoiled and we both want to do what we want to do. And the idea of like having to answer to, you know, not being able to do what we want to do and having to answer to that editorial oversight is not super exciting. It's really not exciting at all. I mean, we've just really enjoyed doing what we do and having only each other to bounce it off of. So yeah, we just didn't go through the Marvel DC stuff, and basically John knocked around for a year and did a bunch of other creator-owned stuff, and I basically kicked back for a year and was developing Farmhand while doing a cover here, there, a short story here and there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I always knew I would come back to writing my own thing, if only for whatever reason, I always felt like I was supposed to.
Well, it's put you in a really rare position, I suppose, in that, you know, you're known for doing one thing. It was completely creator-owned. It was you know, you had complete control over it, and it was really successful and lasted for a long time. So, I were you ever concerned that, like, you didn't have enough experience doing different things? Or it was almost like, this is the thing you have experience in, so you might as well go for it because it's worked before.
Yeah, no, I think it's, that was like I said, I was absolutely in the wilderness that last year of CHU and then last year, where it's like, you know, basically all of the fears that I had initially about, like, well, like, you know, I did have a lot of success very early in my career, but what if it's like a one-hit wonder kind of thing? like I'm only 35. Like, no one wants to peak like that early in their lives. So I had a lot of those initial fears, but at some point I really had to put all of that aside and just really say, okay, what story do I really, really care about? And this is the only story of everything else I had before me that I really genuinely cared about. And it was one of those things where, you know, in the past, you know, anytime an idea would land in my lap, I would immediately run to the internet and see, you know, what out there was like it. Mm-hmm. And I would kill the idea every single time.
I've done that. I have that exact horrible habit.
Yeah. Well, with Farmhand, I got it, and immediately there was a joy that came over me when I got this concept that I made a pact with myself that I would not go looking to see if there's anything like it. Oh. So there is a chance that there is something out there that is exactly like this. But I have no idea because I didn't go looking for it. I literally just wrote from my heart and from what I was really feeling pulled to write. So yeah, hopefully it's unique.
So let's go back then to the beginning. When you were growing up, were you a comics kid? Like, was this a thing that you've always wanted to do?
Yeah, man. I mean, I had two uncles that were gigantic comic fans. I mean, they were kind of like the prototypical, you know, comic book geeks. I mean, they had these huge suitcases full of comics in their closet. And I mean, I would just sift through them. And I mean, I've always been a visual guy. So, like, you know, my mom apparently has, you know, illustrations that I did at age two. Like, I've never seen them, but apparently I was making sequential art from a super, super early age. But yeah, comics were always my thing from day one.
And what kind of stuff did you want to do? Were you reading, like, superhero comics? Or, because this would have put you, you're a little younger than me, so first Image boom sort of would have been when you were coming around, I guess, to sort of, like, noticing that stuff and being the audience for it. Is that what you wanted to do?
Absolutely. I mean, everything I grew up with was superhero stuff. I mean, like, all the stuff my uncles had were, like, you know, George Perez, Teen Titans, and Dreadstar, and a bunch of other, like, amazing stuff. So I grew up with all that stuff. And then when Image debuted right around the time that I was just starting to buy comics for myself. I was, like, age 9 at the time. I was actually just thinking about this yesterday because I just saw, you know, I'm going to be in a panel with Todd McFarlane coming up soon. So I had this really crazy moment of, holy crap, like, this is crazy. Like, I still remember going to my local comic shop and picking up, you know, comic shop news. And they, you know, on the covers, like, Spawn, and there's, like, a 5-page preview for Spawn number 1. I'm like, what is this? So, like, that just changed everything for me. But what's funny is the very first Image comic I ever bought was not Spawn or Youngblood or any of those books. It was Brigade. Brigade was my first Image comic, and I was all about it. Totally.
Is that a Youngblood spinoff? Because I don't know that stuff particularly well.
It essentially is. It's Rob Liefeld. It was like the less successful Youngblood. It was way more generic, and it was classic Liefeld. But I still have it. I still have it, like, polybagged and boarded somewhere.
But, so did you always have, I guess, a cartoony style, for lack of a better word?
I actually tried, because I didn't discover, like, indie comics until much later. So, I mean, even the Image stuff was still superheroes. So, like, I you know, this is pre-internet, so I still thought, you know, if you draw – this is what comics are. Comics are guys in spandex with abs showing somehow through the clothes. Like, this is what comics is. So I figured, you know, if I want to do this professionally, which I, at the time, honestly, I didn't even know that it was a real job. Mm-hmm. Like, it never occurred to me that, holy crap, this is a thing I could conceivably do someday. It was just something I did in my free time. But yeah, like, I didn't discover the indie stuff until college, actually, because I had been drawing it. I'd been drawing superhero stuff for years, but I always sucked at it. Like, I was just never any good at it. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, just literally just screwing around with something, I did a cartoony style. And a friend of mine at the time was just like, hey, you know, this is good stuff. Like, this may be your thing. And what's funny is I just kind of laughed it off and said, well, you know, I was just screwing around. You know, I didn't put all kind of crazy time drawing abs and drawing veins and all this stuff. It was just a really simple style that I was really just focusing on storytelling and the fundamentals. And from there, I kind of grew the style. And I mean, this has been, you know, I mean, that was back in 2001. So yeah, this has been a pretty long journey.
It's funny because for me, when I think of like the moment that I went, oh, comics can look different. And I didn't really try to be an artist, but I was aware of it in that I remember seeing McFarlane's Spider-Man originally. And I thought, oh, it doesn't have to look like John Byrne.
Yeah.
And that to me was extraordinarily freeing. And like, I always have gravitated more towards that, even in a superhero context. Mm-hmm. And so I always think like that is a thing that must have spurred people to be like, oh, I can draw differently. You know, I think Scotty was definitely affected by that in sort of the same way. He's one of those guys.
Yeah.
You sort of look like you're in that same vein too, stylistically.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, the guy that really blew it up for me was Jim Mahfood.
Yeah.
I mean, back when I was really like, in 2001, in 2001, I literally said to myself, okay, I'm going to unlearn everything I've learned. So I stopped. I dropped tons of detail, and I actually have this stuff on my my website, just some really old stuff where I was drawing. It wasn't like stick figures, but it was way more like Hanna-Barbera versus like, you know, Marvel. And I was just focusing on form and simplicity and storytelling, and I built it up from there. And Mahfood's stuff was the first thing that jumped out at me. And from Mahfood, I got turned on to guys like Dave Crosland, who actually Crosland did a book with John, with Layman, called Puffed. That was also an Image around that time. And that actually, I started following Layman from that time on. So whenever he actually emailed me for Chew, I knew exactly who he was, which surprised the hell out of him. Because like, I was like the one guy who bought Puffed. guys like Jim Mahfood were pretty huge for me.
So, like, at what point did you decide you were going to get serious? Because if you were thinking about things like storytelling and, I mean, what did you go to college for?
I went to college. I actually got into college for computer animation. Mm-hmm. And not because I like computers, because, you know, I was going to the University of Louisiana in Lafayette. And there weren't a lot of options for working. There weren't a lot of working artists around. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone, you know, the guy that is kind of like the pinnacle of Louisiana art success is a guy named George Rodrigue, which, no offense to Mr. Rodrigue, but like, he's basically known for the Blue Dog. I don't know if you've ever seen this.
No.
Okay. It's basically just a blue dog that is on assorted things. And like, that's it. Like, he's a huge phenomenon. So like, he was kind of the pinnacle of what it looked like to be successful as a working artist. And no one else had done it. So like, I had no picture of like, you know, what this even looked like. But whenever I got into college, that was when I started going to conventions. And, we didn't have any in Louisiana at the time. We would drive to Texas. We drove to LA for a couple times for shows. And then from there, I kind of like built up the network.
Were you putting your artistic career like in the context of what it would have to be like if you were from Louisiana?
Oh man, thankfully the internet was in at this time. I mean, this is like 2001, 2002. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, it started clicking, holy crap, you know, because I was meeting people on message boards. I'd hang around, I'd post on like 5 different message boards every week. So I was actually really like religious, and I had a ritual going every week. Like I was working for the school paper, and I was the head cartoonist for like 5 years. And so I was meeting deadlines. I did 2 weekly strips. And every week I would post those strips on like 5 different message boards. Like the Dark Horse board was one of them. I think Pencil Jack was another one. They were just all over the place. And as I was doing that, I was networking with tons of different artists and writers. And then I was doing the shows, and it occurred to me that, okay, none of these people I'm networking with are in Louisiana. So I don't even think it matters where I live. Mm-hmm. Like, this is, it was game changing. And it's actually been really, really good. I mean, I think Louisiana is probably one of the better places to start out as a starving artist, because, you know, cost of living is so dirt cheap here, and the food is really, really, really good. So, you know, it actually ended up being a good thing for me.
It's funny because I think, I mean, Louisiana plays a big part in the new book. You didn't really ever have, like, I want to get out of here thing going on. It seems like like it.
No, I absolutely want to get out of here.
Oh, okay.
No, I was, my entire college career, I was like, there's no way I'm staying here. There's nothing here. And then I like fell in love and got married, and I was like, oh, I think we're staying. You know, she had like family land and, you know, surrounded by crawfish fields and soy fields and all this stuff. And it's like, okay, this is like really, really nice. And, then, you know, we started traveling and, seeing the world whenever Chew hit. And, you know, the more I got out, I would come home and realize I really liked it here. And it surprised the hell out of me. And then we started having kids, and yeah, we're just planted here. I mean, my family's here, everyone's here. And, I at some point I really started having an appreciation for this place.
How are you weaving that into Farmhand?
Farmhand takes place in a town called Freetown, which is actually, it's a real place in Louisiana, but it's, Farmhand is essentially the Farmhand Freetown is an extrapolation of the real Freetown. The real Freetown is this little place in Lafayette, Louisiana, where basically pre-Civil War and after Civil War, after emancipation, basically these abolitionists got together with former plantation owners. They bought this land, and they basically created a community of a super diverse community where freedmen of color combined with the abolitionists basically brought in all of these newly freed slaves, and they basically acclimated them for their future life. It's a real place. Mm-hmm. That's actually my old studio where I was drawing Chew was actually in Freetown. So it's a real place. It's a really like special, very diverse, funky place in Louisiana. And in Freetown, in Farmhand, Freetown is that place. So it's very racially diverse. It's a race kind of like, I wouldn't say isn't an issue in Freetown, but the thing about Freetown is everyone is so incredibly diverse, and it's the case for a lot of Louisiana, really, with especially with Cajun culture, Creole culture.
Right.
You can't really tell who's what. So like everyone is very, very, very diverse. So that's kind of what the setting is for Farmhand, and that's where I'm working from.
Is that a way for you to, I'm trying to phrase this, but to either make diversity an issue in the book or not an issue?
I don't think it is an issue, but I mean, mm-hmm. This is like on Chew is a really, really diverse book, but it wasn't a thing that we ever set out to do. I never had an agenda with Chew where I was just shoving in like, you know, well, there need to be like this many black people in the book or whatever. It was always, I always looked at it and I would approach it from two things. First, I would approach it as an artist. Okay, what looks good on the page? I need diversity of shape, diversity of color for this to be interesting.
Yeah.
But at the same time, on a personal level, I grew up in a very diverse family. I mean, my family is everything from like Italian, Black, German, Mexican, Native American, like everything is represented in my family. So I just grew up with this. I mean, my dad, I'm Black, but my dad could pass for white, and like people think he's white. He has green eyes, and he's Cajun, he's Creole. So like I grew up in this. So I'm kind of naturally bringing it to this book. And it's I'm very curious if this is going to be an issue for anyone, but yeah, it's not something I'm really.
If it is, it's not going to be your fault.
Yeah, like it's I don't know. But I'm just really trying to be true to what I grew up in and what I currently live in with my kids. My wife is white and our kids are biracial, and people are constantly wondering, like, my kids could pass for anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, my daughter looks like Moana. I mean, and my oldest son looks like, I mean, he could be like Israeli or something. I have no idea. These kids are just so crazy, beautiful, and intermixed. Yeah. And I'm kind of bringing that to the book.
That's going to be the best future for us all, when we're all just a medium brownish, you know, no one can tell, and then everyone can get past it. Now, that's not a good solution. I don't know. Anyway, let's move it along back to, so you're on these message boards, you are trying to make headway, you're trying to get somewhere, you know, what's the first thing that happens that sort of feels like you're moving in that direction?
I had a lot of kind of false starts. I mean, every comic creator has a million. I mean, I did 100 pages of a creator-owned thing with that was me and a writer, and like, it will never see the light of day. I mean, it's really, really sad.
I've written a couple of those.
Yeah. I spent like 3 years on this thing, and I can't show anything to anyone because the guy's, he's kind of crazy. So I don't want to start any trouble. But yeah, like, I guess the first
was real, it good?
I don't know. I mean, I think my art style developed on it. So visually, I think it's good. Mm-hmm. But it's also one of those things where, you know, we were making this back in, this is early 2000s. So like, it was a very different time. So I think there's some things, some jokes that we made then that would never be accepted today.
Sure.
So it's probably for the best. It never gets out there.
Understood. Yeah. So that was 3 years.
Yes. That was 3 years of
and
my
this,
life.
And this whole time you're doing this on the side, you're working somewhere, you know, you're working on a job, you're doing what?
Yeah. I mean, I actually started most of this stuff while I was still in college. Cause I've always kind of been, I've always wanted to start early on whatever I'm doing, just so in case I fail, I'll have like a time to like, you know, to fix it. Like, my worst fear was hitting 30 and never having like accomplished anything. So I was 19, already going to shows, bringing my portfolio around, and I was dead serious about it. Mm-hmm. And at some point, my first big bite came actually via MySpace, of all places. Because, I mean, this is pre-Facebook, pre-everything. So this is my MySpace. MySpace was a place to be. And, you know, while people were posting, you know, their selfies or whatever, they're like prototypical selfies. You know, I was using it as a portfolio because I didn't have a real website yet. And then one day out of the blue, this guy named CB Cebulski, like, hits me on MySpace. And he's like, hey, you know, I love your work. It's got a lot of personality. And I'm like, who the hell is this guy? Like, who is this? And then I Googled him. I was like, oh, shit, he's the talent scout at Marvel Comics. Okay. like, cool. And from there, like, CB really started the train for me. Like, he ended up introducing me to the then president of Tokyo Pop. So I was actually working for Tokyo Pop for a couple years after then. Again, none of it ever came out. I actually never got paid for any of it. That's a whole other story. But that actually, the writer I was working with on the Tokyo Pop thing just so happened to be friends with John Layman. So whenever John came up, you know, was finally decided to do Chu, he reached out to this mutual friend of ours and they referred me. And that's how John and I hooked up.
And was that love at first sight?
Well, it was for me because I literally had I quit my job like a week before. So like my wife and I was working a night job. Mm-hmm. I had been working a night job for about 3 years in the oil field. Just like I was basically a dispatcher for an oil field company. So like I was, you know, working night shifts. My wife was working during the day. We'd never see each other. And at some point we just decided, OK, we were in our first year of marriage and we just decided this sucks. Like, I like never see you. So, you know, if I'm going to do this comic thing, now is the time for me to risk it. Cause we didn't have kids at the time and she had a good job at the time. So we basically, you know, made a 5-year pact that, you know, I had 5 years to make this thing happen. And then if it didn't happen, I was going to have to get a real job and we were going to start having kids.
I just thought that's not enough time.
Well, I mean, at that point I had I mean, this is 2008.
Okay.
So at that point, I had been pushing for 7 years, and I actually had a pretty decent amount of contacts. And at San Diego Comic-Con, this was me and her made the pact. Literally, I mean, this was Independence Day 2008. So like 3 weeks later was Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. So I just decided, like, well, I know I'm going to Comic-Con. I'm just going to go to Comic-Con, and like I'm just going to rush Comic-Con and make some work happen somehow. And then the day before Comic-Con, I get an email from John Layman, who I'd actually met once a year before, though he doesn't remember it, of course. But he just emailed me. He's like, hey, man, you know, I got your number through Brandon. And yeah, you know, I got this thing called Shoot. And he no-sold me on it. Like I had no idea what it was. Mm-hmm. But he's like, yeah, it's a police procedural with aspects of horror and comedy. And it was the most general pitch ever. I was like, I don't know what this is. But I knew I loved his work, and I knew I was looking for work, and I knew that this was going to be an Image comic. So I was all in from the beginning.
And did you have an idea about, did you have a fully formed idea about what it was to you? Like, did you take time to, find what your style was going to be in it, or find sort of how to do it, or did it just start clicking?
No, I mean, I actually, in the back of the very first Shoe hardcover, in the bonus features, we have the first test page I did for Shoe. And it was awful. It was total garbage. Because at this point, John told me that he had been pitching it around to Vertigo and companies like that. So I, you know, up to that point, everyone I'd worked with, all the publishers I worked with, because I'm a very, like, very versatile artist, like, I can mix it up. So people would say, like, you know, could you draw more like, you know, Ben Temple Smith, or draw more like Scotty Young or whatever? Like, no one wanted me to do me. Mm-hmm. So like I was used to that. So I assume John did not want me to just draw the way I wanted to. So when I kind of did a Vertigo-ish style for this test page and sent it to him, and he hated it completely. And, you know, I asked him, well, what are you looking for? And he's like, well, you know, he's looking at my website and I have a bunch of stuff of just me screwing around in my free time. And he's just like, well, can you do that? I was like, well, yeah, that's actually how I draw. It's just that no one's ever actually wanted to pay me for the way I draw. And then, yeah, I just jumped in and did what I wanted to do. And that ended up being the Chew style.
It's funny because, like, that's the after-school special version of how you're supposed to make art. And yeah, there's a lot of people for whom it does not work out. But, like, just do you. But nobody wants it to be like me. Do it and you'll shine. And then you did. That's nice.
Yeah, no. It ended up working out. It couldn't. I mean, it was – there's still – if you look at the first few issues – there's markers for me where I started getting more and more comfortable, because in the beginning I still didn't believe he actually wanted me to do me, because like, you know, me, I mean, when I go all me, it can get really goofy.
Did you know who you were at that point?
Well, I knew I've always loved like anime can get really silly. Mm-hmm. And I think when I started really settling in and realizing, oh, I could do whatever I want on this thing, was issue 3. And issue 3 is the Amelia Mintz issues, where he meets his future wife, and he's like totally in love with her, love at first sight. And there's this one panel where he's like super goofy, and he has hearts around his head. And this sounds super silly, but up to that point, Shu had been a relatively serious book. I mean, it was goofy, but it was still police procedural. And I had basically brought in all of a sudden this goofy anime element into it, and it was totally okay. So that was when I started getting really, really comfortable with it. And, you know, from there, it just got crazier and crazier.
So you just started doing, I mean, was it, I'm wondering where in the process you just started to feel completely comfortable to be like, I'm going to put in what I want here, and I know it's going to be okay, and I know it's going to be appropriate. Was there ever a point where Layman needed to pull you back, or?
No. I mean, I think I have a pretty good gauge of, you know, how far is too far. You know, I'm pretty tame in most aspects of my life.
Sure.
So like, I think when I got really comfortable, it wasn't until after, man, I think probably issue 11 was probably when I started getting really, really comfortable. But that was this really interesting hump that we hit early on in the first five issues that I've never really talked about publicly. Mm-hmm. But like, we actually, you know, I was making the art like for the first few issues for a full year before the first issue ever came out, because I was only doing it part time. And then it came out and it did really, really well. Right after issue two came out, John and I went to San Diego Comic-Con, and it was our very first Chew Comic-Con. And it was freaking crazy. Like, we were swamped. All these people were coming over. It was the first time in my life I've had people come over and were just like, you know, like, oh my God, I love your work. Like, shaking my hands.
2009?
Yeah, it was 2009. I think this is when we met.
Yeah, it would have had to have been. Because I was full time on this at that point. So we were going to all the shows at that point.
Yeah. But I mean, it was the most surreal thing ever. And then when we got home from San Diego Comic-Con, I think we both freaked out, because it got real at that point.
That's what I was going to ask. Like, at what point were you like, wow, this is a thing? Yeah. So that would have been then, I guess.
Oh, yeah. No, I couldn't draw for a full week after Comic-Con, because I just got back and I was like, holy crap. I was used to making art for myself in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And it became a very different thing when it was, you know, there's all these people reading it. And I ended up having to really separate myself. And ended up making this post-it note, writing this post-it note that says that it says there are no fans, and I still have it. I still have it to this day on my desk, because I just can't think about it. Like, it freaked me out thinking about what people would think. And with Farmhand, that's been amped up even more. Like, I really had to take a step back and forget about people and not care what people think and just make what I want to make.
So how have you been able to check yourself with it? Do you have an editor on it? Or are you showing it to people? Are you, you know, just a, or are you just going by instinct?
I have a handful of guys that I really trust. Like, Layman's one of them. Layman is one of the first guy I came to with it, and just said, hey, you know, what do you think about this? And he thought it was great from the beginning, and he's actually been super supportive. But yeah, Layman, Cody Chamberlain, who's a comic artist and writer, who's actually doing my lettering on Farmhand. And he also did the logo design for it. David Harper, who amazing comics journalist from a site called Sketched, who's I've kind of been picking guys that I really trust who actually have good taste. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's the most important factor here. I need people who are going to tell me, hey, this sucks. Like, don't do this. Just don't do this. And I mean, that was my thing with Layman from the beginning was, you know, don't be kind to me on this. Like, if this is trash, please tell me it's trash. But if it's not, you know, tell me that too, because I need to, I really want to get better at this writing thing.
Let me specify then. As you're going through Chew, I'm assuming you're learning a hell of a lot because you're just sort of learning as you're going. What's something that you sort of picked up from either working with Layman or just from publishing that book that so many people started reading instantly that you are still thinking about now as you're producing your own book?
I think I really learned. I mean, just in terms of kind of skills and attitudes I picked up on Chew, I learned how not to care. I mean, I think, you know, I remember when issue one came out of Chew. And it was my first like solo comic, you know, this thing where I, you know, it wasn't a bunch of artists. It was just me and John. And I saw it on the stands and I saw all these imperfections and it freaked me out. And I would look at every issue for the first few issues and just agonize over what I didn't do or what I did do. And at some point, because we were moving so fast, and, you know, on a monthly comic, on almost monthly comic, I mean, you're moving quick. So at some point, I just really learned how to let it go and just get it, you know, I just kind of let it go. I do my best. And then I decide, you know, I look at it in hindsight and decide, okay, well, I'm not going to do this again. I'll do it better this time. So I think I've stopped caring a bit and I've also like learned to forgive myself a bit more.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let me. That's a good answer and it's fine, but I'm going to keep going because I want to know, like, from a storytelling standpoint, What do you know to do now when you're either constructing the story as a whole or building a page or doing something like what do you know now as a veteran when you're sort of actually making your comic book and sort of the craft part?
I think I've gotten a lot more deliberate in terms of how I outline. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, I wrote a lot of my own stuff before Chew, but with Farmhand, I've really had to, I've kind of had to rediscover, you know, how I write. So like my process is really kind of fluid. Like I really do have my process down on Farmhand. In a nutshell, my process is, you know, I'll sit down. It all starts with like a one sentence kind of blurb about what this issue is going to be. And then from there, I'll kind of sculpt it out. I'll literally sit with a sheet of paper and just, you know, I must look like a lunatic when I write, because I just stare off and like I have a really nice window on the second floor of my office, and I just kind of stare out of it. And I will sit there with a sheet of paper and just write down scene by scene what comes to me. Mm-hmm. And it actually flows out. I have a pretty natural sense of a scene transition and things like that. And I just kind of sculpt it out that way. And then from that, I'll plug it into Word. I'll start working. I usually work in Microsoft Word. And then from there, I'll kind of like script it, like actually detail it with dialogue and whatnot.
So I don't know if that answers your question. Before you draw it?
Oh yeah, yeah, and a completely full script. And I actually have a couple different versions of it. Like I usually, now that we're actually, you know, lettering it and whatnot, like basically I do a final version of the script, and then I draw the entire thing. And then after I finished drawing it, I'll actually go back and tweak the script to basically, like, you know, if I see, you know, this panel's got too much stuff in it for all this dialogue, I'll go back and trim stuff up and basically make a lettering version of the script for Cody, who does the letters. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question at all.
Yeah, no, it works. It's process stuff. I always like process stuff. And I like to learn about the lessons that people sort of take from doing their own work and over time. So
yeah,
it's the part that I think people who are making comics or learning how to make comics or even learning how to understand comics don't really always understand what it is about them that makes them good. And it's been that's sort of my favorite part of everything I've ever done with iFanboy and everything, is sort of learning about that, you know, and knowing, oh, that's why this page is good. And I just like that. So I like to hear what other people have to say about that.
Well, I'll say this. What's been really interesting is, you know, after 8 years of working with John, you know, working with another human being, mm-hmm. it's really interesting how I can kind of separate myself. Like I'll usually write, you know, at this point I'm writing my issues months in advance of me actually drawing it. So there's a distance there. So whenever I go back, you know, and I pick up a script and I start thumbnailing it, it's really like someone else wrote this. So there's a real separation there. So I actually feel a lot of freedom to go in and change my own stuff as I'm working on it. So yeah, it's a really weird thing.
What do you like to draw and what do you not like to draw?
What do I not? Man, I like to draw animals.
No one likes to draw animals. That's amazing.
Yeah. I don't like drawing horses. I mean, no one likes to draw horses.
No one likes to draw. That's all that's my go-to joke usually. Who wrote all these horses?
Well, I mean, I actually did a 4-page short story for God Hates Astronauts. Mm-hmm. And the main character is a floating horse head guy. And horse heads are a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Every other part of the horse is a major pain. Huh. Yeah, it's weird.
You know why that is? Mm. That isn't me asking because I know the answer. I'm just curious what it is. Like, what makes a horse harder than a dog?
I don't know. I don't like horses. I mean, they're just a pain. But yeah, I don't. I like animals. Like I like drawing like, you know, raccoons and furry animals and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I actually had a story. I had a story of, like, you know, where all the main characters were animals. Mm-hmm. And then Zootopia came out, and then like I was on Twitter or something, and I clicked on the Zootopia. I was looking for reviews or something, and I effed up and like clicked on the Zootopia hashtag, and it was just a bunch of porn. And I was like, oh no. So like I immediately scrapped my idea. Like, completely.
What did that have to do with the porn?
Yo, no, it was Utopia porn.
I see. I see. I get. Yeah. No, okay, I see. I understand.
Yeah. There's some things you can't unsee.
Yeah, that's true. And then your browser knows you were there. It's a whole...
It's bad. Bad stuff.
Yeah. I think we're going to wrap up pretty soon, but let me... I'm curious, so... Chew is moving. You're in the middle of this thing. 8 years is a really long time. During that time, did you have other opportunities that came up? And was it ever a question of like, maybe I will do something else in the middle of this, or we'll put this on hold, or were you, you know, on Chew hell or high water no matter what?
Yeah, I there were things that popped up here and there. I mean, nothing, you know, earth shattering, but I mean, I think there were a lot of little offers here and there, but I mean, I knew as a fan, I always hated it when artists kind of flaked out. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had so many books that I was just a huge fan of that I was all in on. And then the next thing you know, like the artist craps out after four issues and the new artist just is not nearly as good. And I still have bitterness as a fan. like, you know, Battle Chasers back in the day.
Yeah.
Like, I'm still like, that's like my Alamo. It's like, oh no. It's like, why would he do that? And I knew I didn't want to do that to anyone. Like I always had this level of gratitude toward the fans for really like supporting this and really making it successful. And I never wanted to let them down. And I knew I was in a very, unique position where this is, you know, my very, very first thing. And how many people have the opportunity to have a 60 issue run under their belt, like from the beginning. So like, no, I never had any thoughts of leaving. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always wanted to make it as awesome as I could. I always wanted to be this one. If I did nothing else in my career, I wanted this to be as good as it possibly could be. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So as you're about to launch sort of a new book, a new phase, a new thing, how do you see comics? Are you thinking about how comics are different now than they were, you know, in 2008, 9, as opposed to now? Is that a thing you're thinking about? Or is that a thing that you're like, I'm not going to think about that?
I can't think about it because it freaks me out.
Sorry. I was in the middle of asking you, and you shouldn't ask this. This is terrible.
Yeah, no, don't make me think about it. It gives me panic attacks. But no, I mean, it's when Chew came out, there was really nothing else going on. Like, it was a quiet point whenever Chew came out. Like, I think Marvel was in this really dark patch where, like, I think they were coming off of like Secret Invasion, and there's like Dark Reign. It was all these really dark.
I can't believe that wasn't longer ago that Chew came out. You said the dates, and I'm like, that's it? That's all? I mean, it was a long time ago. It was a big thing, but it's been a long life.
Yes. I feel like I've aged. I feel like Chew aged me. Yeah. Like, and you know, then having kids on top of that, like I've definitely aged. But like all this dark stuff was coming out in 2008, 2009. And then we came out and we were this goofy, silly book. And I think that like was a major key to us shining. But nowadays, like comics are so, there's so much stuff out there. Mm-hmm. So I have no idea what to expect with Farmhand. It freaks me out a little bit, even just thinking about it. It's an environment where there's so many good books out there that books can fail, not because they sure. suck. It's just, there's only so much money to go around, basically. So like it does scare me a little bit, but I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Actually, I think that's a better way to look at it than, you know, the fact that there are so many books. I think, and it's good that, you know, you're talking about an artist or a creative team staying on a book for a really long time. And you're at a point now where Marvel and DC are both doing bi-weekly shipping. So no artist sticks around for more than four issues before it switches over to the other person, which to me feels like such a disservice to art, you know, and you know, that it's definitely time for something else interesting and fun, but also familiar at the same time. So I really hope it goes well for you. I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. I was happy to be reading it because it was on one hand familiar. It you know, it's your art. I know your art very well at this point. I've been reading it a long time, but it wasn't the same thing. And you know, that's something that I look for. I'm like, oh, it's something different, but that I can hang my head on. So I wish you a ton of luck with that, obviously.
Thank you, man. Yeah, that means a lot. I mean, you're one of the guys that, I mean, from the very beginning, we're always, you know, we're super supportive of our work on Chew. And so, yeah, you're one of the guys that you know, I really hold your opinion in high esteem.
That's why I was scared to read it. But it went fine. It went good. I was happy to read it. But there is a certain point where I'm like, I don't know. I think it's good. I enjoyed it. Like, but I don't know anymore because the work is what it is. It's like when you like a band for a really long time, you're like, oh, this sounds like them. That's great. It makes me happy. But I guess that's what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I really hope. I mean, I think that the Chew fans are looking for something.
Yeah, I bet. And there's nothing to fill that.
Yeah, I mean, the hope is that, you know, those guys come along and they come along for the ride and we can do the entire story. But, you know, we'll see. Awesome. I'm hopeful.
Well, I hope that you're flooded with attention after this and the announcement that will have preceded it by the time I put it out there.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Well, thanks very much. It was really fun. It was good to catch up.
Yeah, man, we'll have to do it again.
Cool.
And that will do it for iFanboys Talksplode. I want to thank Rob for coming by and chatting with me. And I want to thank the iFanboy patrons for making this show's comeback possible. We've been going strong for a while, thanks largely to that. You can go to patreon.com/iFanboy. Of course, you can go to iFanboy.com to find this show to comment on and all the other interviews we've done. I think there's a good chunk of other interviews that we've done over the years, and they're always there for you to listen to. And thanks very much. We'll talk to you soon. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing, and some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away, and, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, one of the things is, like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ifanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ifanboy.